So before we jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. If you're prepping for the Series 66, they have a full course with, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. It's super helpful. Check it out at CertFuel.com. All right, let's get into it.
Sounds good. I'm ready.
Okay, so imagine this scenario. You're running a small, very popular bakery. You make incredible sourdough.
Oh, I love sourdough.
Right, it's the best. So one morning, your delivery van gets parked on this steep incline. The parking brake fails. The van rolls down a massive hill, crashes through a wrought iron fence, and completely flattens the local mayor's million-dollar, prize-winning, historically significant
Oh
rosebuds.
man, that is a bad day.
A terrible day. And the mayor is furious, obviously. Next day, you find out they aren't just suing your bakery business. They're coming for your personal savings. They're coming for your house, your car, and they're probably going to try to take your dog's expensive orthopedic bed.
They absolutely will try, yeah.
And the craziest part is the law says they have every right to do so. Why? Because you didn't file a single piece of paper with the state.
It is it's the ultimate nightmare for a business owner. But honestly, it's the default legal reality for millions of people out there.
Exactly.
And if you don't understand exactly why the law allows that mayor to, take the baker's house, you really cannot do your job as a financial advisor.
Yeah, which is exactly why we're doing this deep dive into the architecture of wealth today. Because if you are studying for the Series 66 exam, you already know you have to understand investments. But, staring at charts and picking small cap tech stocks is totally useless if you don't actually know who your client is in the eyes of the law.
That is the core of it. I mean, the entity type, whether you're sitting across the desk from a living, breathing human being, or maybe an artificial corporation, or a really complex trust that dictates the entire rule book.
It changes everything.
It really does. It determines who has the legal authority to push the button on a trade, how the income from that trade is taxed, what kind of liability the owners face when things go wrong, like the van crash, and exactly what your fiduciary obligations are as their advisor.
And the exam treats this as foundational stuff. Like you can't just memorize a list of acronyms. You have to understand the why behind all these
Right,
rules.
rote memorization will get you in trouble here.
So today, we aren't just going to read you a textbook. We're going to follow a story, right? We're going to introduce a recurring cast of characters, starting with the most basic client type imaginable, and follow their whole life cycle.
Yeah, as they grow a business, partner up, seek out corporate shields, eventually pass away, and try to give all their money away.
It perfectly mirrors how you actually encounter clients in the real world. So let's start at the absolute ground floor with the legal definition of a human being. The term you'll see on the exam is a natural person. What does that actually mean?
So in the legal and financial world, a natural person is simply a living, breathing human being. You are a natural person. I am a natural person. We have pulses.
Hopefully.
Right.
Right.
And this is legally distinguished from an artificial entity like a corporation or a trust, which is essentially just an invisible, legally constructed person that's created entirely by filing paperwork.
Okay, so let's introduce our first character, a natural person. Meet Paula the proprietor. Paula has a dream. She loves baking, so she starts selling her famous sourdough bread.
Good for Paula.
Yeah, she hasn't hired any lawyers. She hasn't filed any complex incorporation docs with the state. She just goes to her local bank, walks up to the teller, and opens a basic individual account to hold her personal savings and the cash she's making from the bread.
Okay, so this is an individual account. It is literally the simplest structure on the planet. One natural person owns it, one natural person controls it.
Makes sense.
And while Paula is alive and baking, it's beautiful. She has total unmitigated control over her investment decisions. If she wants to buy mutual funds, she buys them. If she wants to patch it all out, she cashes it out.
But this raises a massive red flag for estate planning, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's a concept that the exam loves to test what happens to that simple individual account when Paula suddenly dies.
Let me stop right there and actually put you, the listener, in the hot seat. Paula has a standard individual investment account in her name only. She suddenly passes away. If she hasn't taken any special steps, what happens to that money? Does it just automatically get transferred to her kids the next day? I'll give you a beat to think about it. Okay, if you said no, you're right. It gets frozen and it gets sucked into a legal black hole called probate.
Probate is a trap that almost every wealthy individual spends thousands of dollars trying to avoid. Because when a natural person dies holding assets solely in their own name, the law doesn't just take the family's word for who gets the money.
That would be too easy.
Way too easy. So the assets are frozen and they enter probate, which is a court-supervised process of authenticating a will, paying off the deceased person's final debts, and then distributing whatever is left.
I always think of probate like the DMV, but for dead people's money. It is slow, highly bureaucratic, and entirely public.
That public aspect is so crucial. Anyone can go down to the courthouse and see exactly what Paula owned and exactly who she owed money to. And on top of that, probate can take 6 months, 9 months, sometimes years if the family fights over it.
Wow, years.
Oh, yeah. And it's expensive. The court fees and lawyer fees are paid directly out of Paula's estate before her kids see a single dime.
So imagine Paula's kids trying to pay for her funeral and the bank just stonewalls them. Like, sorry, your mom's account is locked up in probate court. Check back in 8 months. It's a nightmare. So as her advisor, how do you save Paula from the probate trap while she is still alive without making her set up some insanely complicated legal entity?
It all comes down to a single, incredibly powerful form. The transfer on death or TOD designation. You might also see it referred to as a payable on death or POD designation, usually for bank accounts.
So if Paula fills out a TOD form and names her daughter as the beneficiary, what happens the actual moment Paula dies?
The TOD acts like an express bypass lane around the entire court system. The moment Paula passes away and, you know, a valid death certificate is presented to the brokerage firm, ownership of those assets transfers immediately and directly to the named beneficiary.
She skips the whole court process.
It bypasses probate entirely. It doesn't even matter what Paula's will says, and it doesn't matter if creditors are lining up at the courthouse. That TOD contract supersedes the will for that specific account.
Okay, that is a massive exam takeaway right there. Individual accounts go through the nightmare of probate unless there is a transfer on death designation on file. Memorize that, listeners. It's simple, but they will test it. Now, let's pivot from her personal savings account back to her sourdough hustle. Paula is selling bread out of her garage. She's starting to make real money. But again, no paperwork with the state. What exactly is she operating as legally?
Legally, Paula is operating a sole proprietorship. That's an unincorporated business owned and operated by one natural person. And the fundamental rule you must understand here is that the law sees absolutely zero separation between Paula the human being and Paula's bakery.
They are the exact same legal entity.
Exactly the same.
Which brings us back to my runaway van scenario from the intro. The van flattens the mayor's rosebush. The mayor sues for $1 million. If Paula had formed a corporation, the mayor could only sue the corporation. But because she's a sole proprietor, the mayor is suing Paula personally.
Right. Because there's no legal separation, the sole proprietorship provides zero liability shield. This is called unlimited personal liability.
Unlimited, meaning no cap.
None. If the business is sued, or if the business goes bankrupt and owes suppliers $100,000, the creditors don't just stop when the business bank account hits zero. They can, and they will, come directly after Paula's personal assets.
Her house, her car, her retirement accounts, they pierce right through the business because there is literally no veil to pierce. She's totally exposed. So, walking onto a battlefield with no armor, why on earth does anyone operate this way?
Well, two main reasons, really. First, it is incredibly easy. There are no state filing fees or annual reports. You just start doing business. And second, the taxation is incredibly straightforward. It uses something called pass-through taxation.
Pass-through taxation. This is a huge theme for the exam. Let's break that down.
Yeah.
How does the IRS view the money Paula makes from selling her sourdough?
Because Paula and the bakery are the exact same legal person, the bakery itself does not file a separate corporate tax return. It pays no taxes on its own. Instead, all the revenues and all the deductible expenses of the business just pass through the business entity and land directly on Paula's personal tax return, which is Form 1040.
But how does she separate, like, her normal W-2 income from a day job or investment income from her bakery income on that Form 1040?
She uses a specific attachment called Schedule C. This is a highly testable detail. Schedule C is used to report profit or loss from a business operated as a sole proprietorship.
Okay, Schedule C for the sole proprietor. That is the mnemonic, listeners. Schedule C, sole proprietor. Drill that into your head. Now, because it passes through directly to her, the money is only taxed once. She avoids corporate taxes entirely, but there is a massive hidden trap here. Right?
Yes, the self-employment tax trap. The exam was to make sure you know that avoiding corporate tax does not mean avoiding payroll taxes.
Yeah, the IRS always gets their cut.
Always. Because Paula is both the employer and the employee of her sole proprietorship, she is responsible for paying both halves of the FICA taxes, that's Social Security and Medicare, on her net business income.
Which is how much?
That's roughly 15.3% right off the top, before she even starts calculating her actual income tax brackets.
Ouch. So summarizing Paula's situation, one owner, zero legal separation, unlimited personal liability where her house is constantly on the roulette table, and pass-through taxation via Schedule C, where she gets hit with hefty self-employment taxes.
It's stressful.
It is. In fact, Paula is terrified. She just learned about the Rosebush liability, and she wants to expand her business, but she desperately wants to share the risk. She needs capital, she needs help, and she wants someone else to carry the burden with her.
A very natural evolution for a business. She can't shoulder alone, so she looks for a partner.
Enter our next character, Gary the General Partner. Gary is a smooth talker. He has a little bit of cash saved up, and he knows how to sell bread to local restaurants. So Paula and Gary meet at a diner. They shake hands over a cup of coffee, and they agree to run the bakery together and split the profits 50-50. Boom, they're in business.
And legally, that simple handshake over coffee is entirely sufficient to form a general partnership, or a GP. You need to know for the exam that a general partnership requires absolutely no formal state filing.
Wait, really? No paperwork at all?
No registration with the Secretary of State, no formation fee. The moment two or more natural persons agree to carry on as co-owners of a business for profit, a general partnership is legally born.
It's wild that you can create a business entity by accident just by acting like partners. Okay, let's look at the taxes first, because Paula loved her pass-through taxation. Does she lose that by partnering up with Gary?
No, she actually keeps it. A general partnership is also a pass-through entity. The partnership itself doesn't pay federal income tax. At the end of the year, they file an informational return, but the actual profits and losses flow through to Paula and Gary individually.
But they can't both use Schedule C anymore, right? We just said Schedule C is for solo acts.
Correct. Instead, the partnership issues each of them a tax document called a Form K-1. The K-1 details exactly what their specific share of the profits, losses, deductions, and credits are.
Okay, so they take those K-1s and plug the numbers into their personal 1040s, pass-through taxation via Form K-1. Got it. But let's get back to Paula's main motivation. She brought Gary in to share the burden of liability to protect her house. Does a GP actually do that?
This is where we need to talk about agency authority, which is the core danger of a general partnership. In a GP, every single partner is an agent of the partnership.
Meaning what, exactly?
This means any partner can generally bind the partnership to contracts in the ordinary course of business without ever needing the explicit permission of the other partners.
Hold on, let me push back on this because it sounds crazy. Are you saying Gary can go out and sign massive contracts that Paula has to pay for, even if Paula explicitly told him not to? Why wouldn't a bank or a vendor stop him and ask for Paula's signature too?
Because the law protects innocent third parties. If a vendor sees Gary wearing a bakery uniform, driving the bakery van, and presenting himself as a partner, they have the right to assume he has the apparent authority to buy bakery supplies.
They don't know the behind-the-scenes drama?
Right. The vendor doesn't know about Gary and Paula's internal disagreements. So if Gary signs a contract, the partnership is legally bound to it.
Oh, this is a disaster waiting to happen. Listeners, let's build out an absurd scenario to make this stick. Gary, the general partner, fancies himself a visionary. He goes to a restaurant supply trade show without telling Paula. He gets smooth-talked by a salesman and signs a massive ironclad contract on credit to purchase 10,000 left-handed spatulas.
Left-handed spatulas.
Yeah, he thinks they're going to corner an untapped market. It is a terrible business decision. The spatulas arrive. They can't sell a single one. The bill comes due, and the bakery simply doesn't have the cash to pay the supplier.
And this is exactly where the exam trap snaps shut. The spatula supplier isn't just going to shrug and write off the debt. Because this is a general partnership, Paula has joint and several unlimited personal liability for Gary's actions.
Even though she hated the idea.
As long as those actions were in the ordinary course of business, which buying kitchen supplies for a bakery certainly is, she's on the hook.
Paula is on the hook for 10,000 left-handed spatulas she explicitly didn't want. The supplier sues the partnership, realizes the business bank account is empty, and then goes directly after Paula's personal savings. They can take her house. Every single general partner has unlimited personal liability for the debts of the partnership, including the disastrous debts created by the other partners.
That is the major takeaway for the Series 66 right there. A general partnership does not solve the unlimited liability problem. It exponentially multiplies it.
Because now there are two people making decisions.
Exactly. Now you are personally exposed to the bad decisions, the negligence, and the debts created by your partners. You're putting your house on the line for someone else's behavior.
So Paula and Gary are sweating. The left-handed spatula debacle almost bankrupted them. They need a massive injection of cash to survive, desperately. But they know nobody in their right mind is going to join them as a general partner. If you explain to an investor that they could lose their own house because Gary might buy more spatulas, they will run for the hills.
Yeah, nobody's taking that deal.
Nobody. So enter our third character, Larry the limited partner. Larry is a wealthy local dentist. Larry has a ton of cash. He likes the bakery's potential, and he wants a piece of the profits. But Larry wants absolutely nothing to do with buying spatulas, baking bread, or risking his dental practice. He just wants to write a check, go home, and get a return on his investment.
And this specific economic desire is exactly why state legislatures created the limited partnership, or LP.
Mm-hmm.
And let's carefully contrast the GP with the LP, because the exam will test you heavily on spotting the differences.
Okay, let's hear it.
First, unlike a handshake GP, a limited partnership requires formal state paperwork. You actually have to file a certificate of limited partnership with the state.
Why the paperwork? Why can't they just do a handshake like Paula and Gary did?
Because you are asking the state to grant you a special, unnatural legal shield. You're asking the state to say, even if this business owes money, you cannot touch this specific person's personal assets. The state only grants that shield if you formally register and publicly declare who the general partners are and who the limited partners are.
Okay, so they file the paperwork. How does the structure actually work in practice?
An LP must have at least two classes of partners. You need at least one general partner and at least one limited partner. In our story, Paula and Gary remain the general partners. They still manage the daily operations, they make the executive decisions, and unfortunately for them, they still retain unlimited personal liability. They're still totally exposed.
But what about Larry the dentist?
Larry is the limited partner. He provides capital, but he takes on zero management role. Because he's an entirely passive investor, the law grants him limited liability.
Meaning his personal stuff is safe.
Right. His maximum potential loss is capped exactly at the amount he invested. If Larry writes a check for $100,000, the absolute most he can lose is $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
If the bakery goes bankrupt and owes $5 million, the creditors can take Gary's house, they can take Paula's house, but they cannot touch Larry's dental practice or his personal savings.
That is a beautiful shield for an investor. And how are the taxes handled? Do we lose our pass-through status within an LP?
No, the LP is still a pass-through entity. The business pays no tax. Gary, Paula, and Larry all receive K-1s detailing their share of the profits, and they pay taxes on their personal returns.
Okay, listeners, I want you to picture a scenario in your head, because this is exactly where the exam will try to trick you. Put yourself in Larry's shoes. Larry, the limited partner, is sitting in a lawn chair across the street from the bakery on a sunny Tuesday, just proudly watching his investment.
Just relaxing.
Suddenly, he sees a delivery truck pull up. He sees Gary, the general partner, walk out to sign the manifest. Larry squints, and he realizes it's a shipment of another 10,000 left-handed spatulas.
Oh, no. He did it again.
Larry absolutely panics. He knows this almost bankrupted them last time. He gets out of his lawn chair, marches across the street, walks right into the bakery office, grabs the clipboard out of Gary's hand, yells, "You're an idiot, Gary!" and cancels the order himself. He takes charge of the situation. He manages the crisis. So, listeners, I'm giving you a beat. What just happened to Larry's beautiful legal shield? It is completely gone. He just vaporized his own armor.
That is precisely the dynamic the exam wants you to identify. It's known as the control rule. The very moment a limited partner steps out of their passive, silent investor role and participates in the day-to-day management or control of the business, they are legally treated as a general partner for liability purposes.
He crossed the line. The ironclad rule of LPs is, limited partners provide capital they do not manage. If they manage, they become totally exposed.
Yeah.
By grabbing that clipboard and canceling the order, Larry just put his dental practice and his personal house at risk to creditors. And if you think about the why behind this rule, it makes perfect sense, you know. The state only grants you that limited liability protection if you are truly passive. If you're out there making executive decisions that affect employees, creditors, and the public, Well, the law dictates you must be held fully accountable for those decisions, just like a general partner. You can't hide behind a shield while pulling the strings.
It is such a critical distinction. GP means everyone manages, everyone is liable. LP means the GP manages and is liable, while the LP just sits quietly and stays protected unless they interfere.
Right. Stay in the lawn chair.
Stay in the lawn chair, Larry. So where does this leave our characters? Larry is traumatized because he realized how hard it is to sit quietly while Gary makes mistakes. Paula is exhausted from the unlimited liability hanging over her head. They want out of this partnership structure.
Can't blame them.
They want the ultimate holy grail of business entities. They want a structure where everyone gets limited liability, but they also all want the ability to actively manage the business, fire people, and cancel spatula orders without losing that shield. Does a magical structure like that even exist?
It does now, but, you know, it didn't always. This brings us to a relatively modern legal invention called the Limited Liability Company, or LLC. The LLC is incredibly popular today because it essentially takes the absolute best features of a partnership and the absolute best features of a corporation and just fuses them together.
The LLC is the superhero of small business entities. Let's do a side-by-side comparison because the exam will deliberately pit the LLC against the LP to see if you can spot the difference.
Okay, so in a limited partnership, as we just saw with poor Larry, you cannot have both limited liability and management control. You have to pick one. You're either the protected filant partner or the exposed manager. But in an LLC, the owners, who are called members, by the way, not partners, they have a complete limited liability protection, meaning their personal assets are totally walled off from business debts. And crucially, they can actively manage the day-to-day operations of the business without ever compromising that shield.
Let that sink in, listeners. That is a massive, highly testable distinction. In an LLC, Larry can jump out of his lawn chair, cancel Gary's spatula order, fire Gary, hire a new head baker, and completely run the show as the boss, and his personal dental practice is still 100% protected.
Yep. The LLC allows for what's called a member-managed structure, where all owners run the place together, or a manager-managed structure, where they hire specific people to run it. But either way, the liability shield holds firm.
Just remember, much like the LP, you do have to file formal paperwork with the state to create an LLC, right?
Yes. Usually these are called the Articles of Organization. You cannot handshake an LLC into existence. You're asking the state for that magical liability shield, so you have to file the paperwork.
What about taxes? We know partnerships are passed through. Does the LLC get to keep that benefit?
This is where the LLC really flexes its muscle. Tax flexibility. Okay. By default, the IRS taxes a multi-member LLC exactly like a partnership. It's a pass-through entity. The LLC pays zero corporate tax, profits flow through to the members' K-1s, and they pay on their personal returns.
And what if it's just one person?
If it is a single-member LLC, like if Paula just started one on her own, the IRS treats it as a disregarded entity and taxes it exactly like a sole proprietorship on Schedule C.
But wait, I thought I read they have options, like they can choose how to be taxed.
They do. An LLC can simply check a box on an IRS form and elect to be taxed as a C corporation or an S corporation if it makes financial sense for them.
Yeah.
But, you know, by default, they enjoy that pass-through status.
Okay, pushback time. I'm putting myself in the shoes of a skeptical listener right now. If LLCs are so incredibly great, they give everyone an ironclad liability shield, they let anyone manage, they avoid corporate taxes, they have flexible tax elections, why on earth would anyone ever go through the hassle of forming a traditional C corporation? Like, what is the point of the C corp if the LLC exists?
It is a great question. And it really just comes down to the scale of capital you need to raise.
Wow.
LLCs are phenomenal for small, medium, and even some fairly large private businesses.
Yeah.
But C corporations are designed to be massive global engines of capital.
Ah, okay.
The C corp is a totally separate artificial legal entity from its owners, who are called shareholders. The C corp is essentially its own person under the law.
Right. So if Paula, Gary, and Larry form a C corp, Paula isn't really the baker anymore. The C corp is the baker, and Paula is just an employee and a shareholder.
Exactly. And because the C corp is a separate artificial person, it offers things an LLC really struggles with. It offers unlimited life, meaning the corporation continues to exist indefinitely, even if all the original founders pass away.
Right.
It offers freely transferable ownership. You can buy and sell shares of Apple or Microsoft on a public exchange in milliseconds. Whereas transferring ownership in an LLC usually requires the explicit consent of all the other members.
Oh, that makes sense. You can't just sell your piece of the bakery without asking Gary.
Exactly. And crucially, a C Corp can issue multiple different classes of stock. They can issue common stock with voting rights, preferred stock with guaranteed dividends, Class A, Class B. This complex equity structuring is absolutely essential for attracting venture capital and massive institutional investors.
Okay, so if Paula, Gary, and Larry want to take the sourdough bakery public with an IPO or get $100 million in funding from a massive private equity firm, they absolutely need a C Corp. The big money demands the C Corp structure.
They really do.
But here comes the monster hiding in the closet. The massive, glaring disadvantage of the C Corporation that you will definitely see on the exam. Double taxation.
Double taxation is the defining characteristic of a C Corporation's tax profile.
Let's actually look at the math on double taxation, because when you see the numbers, you realize why small business owners hate C Corp so much. Let's say Paula's C Corp bakery has an amazing year. The company earns $100 in pure profit. Because a C Corp is its own separate artificial taxpayer, it has to file its own tax return, Form 1120, and pay corporate income tax on that $100.
Right.
Let's say the corporate tax rate is 21%. The C Corp cuts a check to the IRS for $21. That leaves $79 sitting in the company bank account. Now, Paula, Gary, and Larry want their cut of the profits to buy groceries and pay their mortgages. So the board of directors distributes that remaining $79 to them as a dividend. Here is where the double tax hits. Expert, what happens to Paula's dividend?
When Paula receives her piece of that $79 dividend, the IRS looks at it as her personal investment income, and she has to pay personal income tax on that exact same money again.
It is the exact same dollar of economic profit being taxed twice. Once at the corporate level when the business earned it, and a second time at the individual level when it's distributed to the owners.
Exactly.
I'm going to repeat this conceptually because it is the golden rule of this entire business entity section. Listen up. The C Corporation is the only entity we've discussed that is automatically subject to double taxation. Sole proprietorships, pass-through, general partnerships, pass-through, limited partnerships, pass-through, LLCs, pass-through by default, C Corp, double tax.
If the exam presents a scenario where a business owner is complaining about their profits being taxed at the entity level and again at the personal level, they are operating a C Corporation. It is that binary.
So our characters realize this. They want the formal structure of a corporation. Maybe they like the prestige of shares and a formal board of directors, but they absolutely refuse to pay taxes twice on their hard-earned sourdough money. They want a workaround.
And Congress actually created a specific workaround for domestic small businesses. It's called an S-corporation.
What's the difference?
Well, an S-corp is not a fundamentally different legal entity. It is just a regular C-corporation that has elected a very special tax treatment under subchapter S of the Internal Revenue Code.
It's just a tax election. You form a corporation and then you basically ask the IRS for a favor.
Correct. By filing for S-corp status, the corporation tells the IRS, please do not tax us at the corporate level. Please treat us like a partnership for tax purposes. And if they qualify, the IRS agrees.
So no corporate tax.
Right. The corporation pays no federal income tax. All the income, losses, deductions, and credits flow straight through the corporate veil and land on the shareholders' personal tax returns. Double taxation is avoided entirely, while everyone still keeps their corporate limited liability shield.
It sounds perfect. It's the ultimate cheat code. But the federal government doesn't just hand out free passes to corporations without some serious strings attached. To get that sweet pass-through taxation as a corporation, you have to follow an incredibly strict set of rules. And the exam loves testing these rules because they want to know if you can spot a disqualified S-corp. Expert, why don't you break down the major hurdles?
Sure. To qualify and maintain status as an S-corporation, you must adhere strictly to these restrictions. First, you are limited to a maximum of 100 shareholders. Now, a family, like a husband, wife, and kids, can sometimes count as one single shareholder, but generally the hard limit is 100.
Okay, 100 max.
Second, all shareholders must be individuals who are U.S. citizens or resident aliens.
Let's pause on that one. Why did the IRS restrict it to U.S. citizens and residents? Why can't a foreign investor buy into Paula's S-Corp?
Because of the pass-through nature. If the income passes through to a foreign national living overseas, it becomes an absolute nightmare for the IRS to collect those personal income taxes. The S-Corp was designed to help domestic small businesses, so they require the shareholders to be easily taxable by the U.S. government.
Makes sense.
Furthermore, you cannot have another corporation or a partnership as a shareholder. Only natural persons and certain specific trusts.
Okay, so no massive institutional investors, no foreign venture capital, and a strict 100-person limit. What's the final rule?
Third, and this is the trickiest one, an S corporation can only issue one single class of stock.
Okay, this is where we need to build a scenario, because the exam is going to try to trap you on the definition of one class of stock. Let's say Paula, Gary, and Larry successfully elect S corp status. They are well under the 100 shareholder limit, and they are all U.S. citizens. But Gary is deeply annoying to work with.
As usual.
Right. Gary wants to vote on every tiny detail, from the color of the napkins to the brand of flour. Paula and Larry are tired of Gary having a say, so to silence Gary, they decide to issue two different types of shares, voting shares for Paula and Larry and non-voting shares for Gary. Here is my direct question to you, the listener. Does issuing voting and non-voting shares violate the S Corp one class of stock rule and destroy their pass-through tax status? Think about it. The answer is absolutely no. It does not violate the rule. They are perfectly safe.
We need to explain exactly why, because it definitely feels counterintuitive.
Yeah.
When the IRS demands that an S Corp only have one class of stock, they are looking exclusively at the economics of the shares, not the control of the company.
Oh, the economics.
Right. As long as every single share of stock has identical rights to distributions, meaning every share gets the exact same percentage of the profits when a dividend is declared, and identical rights to liquidation if the company folds, then they are considered one class of stock economically.
So the IRS doesn't care who gets to sit in the boardroom and vote for the directors. Voting versus non-voting is totally fine.
Totally fine.
The exam will try to trick you by saying, Company X issued voting and non-voting stock. Can they be an S Corp? And you will confidently say, yes, they can, because the economic rights are identical. But if Paula and Larry issued themselves preferred shares that guaranteed them a $10 dividend before Gary got anything, that would destroy the S Corp status immediately, right?
Precisely. Because the economic rights are no longer equal. It's a nuance between economic rights and control rights, and it is a highly testable one.
All right, before we move on to the really big money, let's do a quick mental reset. Notice the pattern we just walked through. We have the sole proprietorship, the general partnership, the limited partnership, the LLC, the C Corp, and the S Corp. Every single one of those entities is designed to solve a problem, either the problem of unlimited liability, the problem of double taxation, or the problem of raising capital.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it.
The exam wants you to match the client's problem to the correct entity. If the client is terrified of liability but wants to manage the business, you suggest an LLC. If the client wants to take the company public and issue preferred stock, you suggest a C Corp, but warn them about double taxation. Master that matrix, and you've got points in the bag.
Absolutely.
Now let's transition our story. Fast forward 20 years. Our sourdough bakery business exploded. They franchised it globally. Our characters are incredibly wealthy now. Paula, the proprietor, has millions in the bank. She wants to protect her massive fortune and make sure it's managed correctly for her kids so they don't squander it.
A very common scenario.
Very common. And unfortunately, let's introduce a slightly sad reality of the life cycle. Dave has passed away. Dave was an early wealthy investor in the bakery, a good friend, and now he is gone. So we are officially leaving the world of retail business entities. We are leaving the bakeries and the spatulas behind, and we are entering the world of institutional clients, trusts, and estates.
This is a critical pivot for an investment advisor. When you manage money for a business, you're dealing with owners and managers who are trying to generate a profit. But when you manage money for a trust or an estate, you're dealing with fiduciaries who are bound by strict legal documents. The entire legal and regulatory framework just shifts underneath your feet.
Let's start with Trust 101. What exactly is a trust? I feel like people use the phrase all the time, you know, trust fund kid, trust account. But what is it structurally? Is it a corporation? Is it a bank account?
At its core, a trust is simply a legal arrangement. It's a fiduciary relationship where one party holds and manages property or assets for the benefit of someone else. It's really just a set of rules written on paper. There are three distinct necessary parties to every single trust, and you must know them.
Let's name them so they stick.
First, you have the grantor. You might also see this person referred to on the exam as the settlor, the trustor, or the creator. This is the natural person who creates the trust and funds it with their own personal assets. In our scenario, Paula is the grantor. She is taking her millions and granting them to the trust.
Got it. Paula is the grantor.
Second, you have the trustee. This is the person, or often a financial institution, responsible for legally holding and managing the trust assets. Let's introduce Tommy the trustee.
Tommy the trustee. He's the guy sitting at the desk, making the trades, rebalancing the portfolio, and constantly reading the trust document to see what Paula's rules are.
Crucially, Tommy operates under a strict fiduciary duty. He does not own the money for himself. He must act solely in the best financial interests of the third party.
Which brings us to the third party.
The beneficiary. Let's call her Betty, the beneficiary. Betty is Paula's daughter. She's the one who actually receives the benefits of all this arrangement. She gets the income generated by the investments, or eventually the principal, exactly as the trust document dictates.
So the flow of money is, Paula the grantor gives the money to Tommy the trustee, who is legally obligated to manage it for the benefit of Betty the beneficiary. Grantor, trustee, beneficiary, memorize those roles.
Definitely.
Now let's look at the two main flavors of trusts, because the exam is going to force you to compare them side by side. Revocable versus irrevocable trusts.
This is a massive exam focus. Let's start with the revocable trust, which is often called a living trust. The defining characteristic of a revocable trust is right there in the name. The grantor can revoke it.
Meaning Paula can just cancel it.
Exactly. Paula sets it up, but she maintains total absolute control. She can modify the rules. She can amend the trust. She can fire Tommy and name a new trustee. She can cut Betty out entirely and name a new beneficiary. Or she can just completely dissolve the trust, tear up the paperwork, and take all her money back at any time.
So Paula sets up the trust, but she keeps a firm grip on the steering wheel. But here is the critical question. If Paula has the power to take the money back whenever she wants, what are the tax implications? Does the IRS view this trust as a separate tax entity?
No, they do not. Because Paula retains complete unfettered control, the IRS basically says, look, we know this is a trust on paper, but in reality, we still consider this your money.
Ah.
Therefore, all the assets sitting inside that revocable trust are still considered part of Paula's personal taxable estate when she dies.
So there are zero estate tax savings. If she has $50 million in a revocable trust, she is still getting hit with the estate tax when she dies.
Correct. Furthermore, because Paula can legally access the money anytime she wants, her creditors can also legally access it. A revocable trust offers absolutely zero creditor protection.
Oh, wow. So if the mayor sues Paula over another crushed rosebush and Paula loses, the mayor's lawyers can force Paula to revoke the trust and hand over the cash.
Yes, they absolutely can. And for income tax purposes, the trust doesn't even file a separate return. All the dividends and capital gains earned by Tommy the trustee's investments flow right back onto Paula's personal form 1040.
Wait, I need to stop and ask the obvious question here. If a revocable trust offers no estate tax savings, offers zero creditor protection, and is just taxed like her own personal money, what is the point? Why would anyone pay a lawyer thousands of dollars to set up a revocable trust?
For one massive overriding benefit, it avoids probate.
Oh, right. The DMV for dead people.
Exactly. Remember earlier when we talked about individual accounts getting stuck in that public, expensive, year-long court process of probate?
Yeah.
Assets held in a revocable trust pass entirely outside of the probate system.
Because the trust technically owns them.
Right. Because the trust, not Paula individually, owns the assets. The trust doesn't die when Paula dies. When Paula passes away, Tommy the trustee just seamlessly continues managing the money or distributes it privately to Betty the beneficiary, exactly as the trust document says. No court. No public records, no frozen assets.
Ah, okay. So it's primarily an estate planning efficiency tool. Revocable equals. Keeps control, avoids probate, but no tax benefits and no creditor protection. Now let's look at the flip side of the coin, the irrevocable trust.
With an irrevocable trust, Paula permanently gives up control of the assets. Once she signs the paperwork and transfers her millions into the trust account, she generally cannot unilaterally modify, amend, or dissolve the trust. She cannot just change her mind and demand the money back. She has let go of the steering wheel entirely.
And the why here is vital. Why would a wealthy person permanently give away control of their own fortune while they are still alive?
Because by legally severing her control over the assets, the law now views those assets as no longer belonging to Paula. They're completely removed from her taxable estate. This is the primary vehicle incredibly wealthy people use to mitigate massive estate taxes.
I see.
Furthermore, because Paula no longer owns the assets and cannot legally demand them back, her future creditors generally cannot reach them either. If the mayor sues Paula 5 years after she funds the irrevocable trust, the trust assets are shielded. The irrevocable trust offers significant asset protection.
Okay, so it's a drastic trade-off. Give up all control of your money, but in return, gain estate tax savings and a fortress against lawsuits and creditors. Now, let's talk about the income taxes for an irrevocable trust, because this is an insidious exam trap. The irrevocable trust is not a pass-through entity to the grantor anymore. It is a separate tax entity. It gets its own tax ID number, and it files its own tax return. What is the name of that IRS form?
It files Form 1041, which is the U.S. income tax return for estates and trusts.
Form 1041. Add it to the list, listeners. Schedule C for sole props, K-1 for partnerships, 1120 for C-Corp, 1041 for trusts. But here is the trap. Compressed tax brackets. Expert, explain what compressed tax brackets mean for Tommy the trustee when he's trying to manage this portfolio and minimize taxes.
So when an individual natural person pays income tax, they have to earn hundreds of thousands of dollars in salary before they hit the highest marginal federal tax bracket, which is currently the 37% tier.
Right.
But trusts are subject to compressed tax brackets. An irrevocable trust hits that absolute highest maximum tax bracket at a very, very low level of retained income, historically around $14,000 or $15,000 of income.
Whoa. Well, let me make sure I understand that. If Tommy the trustee earns $20,000 in dividend income inside the trust, and he just leaves that cash sitting inside the trust account, the trust is getting taxed at the highest possible federal rate almost immediately.
Yes. Nearly half of that income could be wiped out by federal and state taxes.
Why did the government make the bracket so punitive for trusts? Why did they compress them?
It goes back to historical tax avoidance, really. Decades ago, extremely wealthy people realized they could just create 50 different trusts and park a little bit of income-generating stock in each one, essentially exploiting the lowest tax brackets 50 times over. Right, so to stop wealthy people from hiding money in trust just to get lower tax rates, Congress compressed the brackets. The law forces the trust into a corner. You must either pay the maximum punitive tax rate on any income you retain inside the trust, or, and this is the key planning strategy you need to know, you must distribute that income out to the beneficiaries.
Ah, so how does distributing the income solve the tax problem?
If Tommy the trustee distributes that $20,000 of dividend income out to Betty the beneficiary, the trust gets to take a tax deduction for the distribution. The trust pays no tax on it.
Okay, so who pays?
Instead, Betty reports that $20,000 on her personal tax return, and she pays taxes on it at her own personal individual tax rate, which is likely vastly lower than the trust's compressed top rate.
That is brilliant. Distribute the income to the beneficiary to avoid the compressed trust brackets. The exam will definitely test your understanding of why a trustee might aggressively distribute income. Okay, direct question for the listener. Think about everything we just covered. Your client sits down in your office, they have $50 million, they tell you, I want to make absolutely sure I avoid estate taxes when I die, and I want to protect this money from lawsuits. Which trust should I use? I'll give you a second.
Yeah.
The answer is irrevocable, because you have to let go of the steering wheel. You have to give up control to get the tax and creditor benefits. If they say they want to keep control of the money, you tell them they have to use a revocable trust, but they will get hit with estate taxes. You cannot have both.
Precisely. Now, let's turn to the other half of this section. We talked about trusts. Now let's talk about estates. Remember our friend Dave the deceased?
R.I.P. Dave. He made a lot of money in sourdough.
Dave's total collection of assets, his bank accounts, his stock portfolios, his real estate that he owned when he died is now legally known as his estate. And just like a trust, an estate is a legal entity that needs a human being to manage it.
Who manages it?
If Dave names someone in his will to handle his affairs, that person is called the executor. If Dave died without a will, the probate court appoints someone to do the job, and they are called a personal representative.
Executor or personal representative. Both of them are fiduciaries. They have a legal duty to manage Dave's stuff carefully while it's sitting in legal limbo waiting to be distributed to his heirs.
Let's briefly distinguish how a trust might interact with an estate, because the vocabulary here is very testable. Mm. We just discussed living trusts, also called inter vivos trusts, which are created while the grantor is still alive and they avoid probate. But Dave could have created a testamentary trust. This is a trust that is written directly into his will. It does not exist while he is alive. It only springs into existence after he dies. And because it is created by the will, all the assets must go through the entire messy probate process before the trust is actually funded.
That is a great vocab distinction. Testamentary equals created by a will goes through probate. Inter vivos equals living trust created while alive avoids probate. Okay, here is a massive exam trap regarding time horizons and investment suitability. Let's say I am the investment advisor and the executor of Dave's estate comes into my office. They sit down and open an estate account with $1 million in cash from Dave's bank accounts.
Okay.
As the advisor, should I take that $1 million and invest it into high growth, small cap tech stocks, or maybe a volatile emerging markets fund? After all, over the long term, equities perform best, right?
If you do that on the exam, you will instantly fail the question. Absolutely not.
Why? Why no high growth equities for Dave's estate? It's $1 million.
Because estates are inherently, fundamentally temporary. An estate is not a generational wealth vehicle. An estate only exists for the exact period of time it takes to settle Dave's affairs, to pay his final medical debts, to pay off his credit cards, to pay his final taxes, and then to distribute whatever cash is left over to his heirs.
So they don't last long.
Right. An estate might exist for 6 months, a year, maybe 2 years, tops. Therefore, the investment objective for an estate account can never be long-term growth. The primary objective must always be capital preservation and liquidity.
Because the executor might need $100,000 in cash next Tuesday to pay the IRS. If you put it all in volatile tech stocks and the market drops 20% next week, you have literally destroyed the estate's ability to pay its debts. Short time horizon equals capital preservation. Money market funds, short-term treasuries, do not risk the principal.
Exactly. And speaking of paying the IRS, the exam expects you to know the specific tax filing requirements and deadlines for an estate. The primary one is the federal estate tax return.
This is the big scary one that taxes the total value of everything Dave owned when he died. What form is that?
That is Form 706. And the deadline is highly testable. Form 706 is due exactly 9 months after the date of death. Now, the executor can apply for a 6-month extension to file the paperwork, but the initial deadline to file and pay the tax is 9 months.
9 months for Form 706.
Yeah.
Got it. Now, what about income taxes? If that $1 million is sitting in an estate bank account for a year earning interest, does the estate have to pay income taxes on that interest?
Yes, they do. The estate is a separate tax entity, just like an irrevocable trust. The estate must file a Form 1041 for income taxes if the estate generates $600 or more in gross income during the administration period.
Okay, so a $600 threshold triggers the 1041 income tax return, and there is a strict 9-month deadline for the 706 estate tax return. That is incredibly testable material. Write those numbers down. All right, take a deep breath. We are in the home stretch. We have followed the business life cycle from Paula baking bread as a sole proprietor, to Gary buying spatulas in a partnership, to Larry hiding behind an LLC, to the double tax C-Corp, and all the way to Dave's death, trusts, and estate taxes.
It's been a journey.
It has. Our characters have made their money, they have protected their money, they have paid their estate taxes. What is the final step in the wealth life cycle? Giving it away. Dave's estate is settled, but Dave had a very, very wealthy friend. Let's introduce our final character, Franny the founder.
Franny the founder.
Franny is in her twilight years. She founded a massive tech company, she has hundreds of millions of dollars, and she doesn't want to just leave it all to her spoiled heirs. She wants to leave a legacy. She wants to give her millions away for a good cause, maybe funding childhood education or cancer research.
Franny is entering the world of tax-exempt institutional clients. And as a financial advisor, managing money for a charitable foundation is a completely different universe than managing money for a standard corporation or a private trust, because they are granted massive tax exemptions by the government.
And with great exemptions comes great responsibility.
Exactly. In return, they are subject to very specific, very strict federal regulations.
Let's break down the two main types of charitable entities you will see on the exam: private foundations versus public charities. From an advisor's perspective, what is the fundamental difference?
It all comes down to the source of the funding. A public charity relies on broad public support. Think of the Red Cross, a large public university, or a local food bank. They get small donations from thousands of different individuals, corporations, and government grants.
Okay, so lots of small donors.
Right. A private foundation, on the other hand, is usually funded by a single major source. It might be one incredibly wealthy individual, like Franny, or a single family, or one large corporation. They take a massive chunk of money, put it into an endowment, and use the investment returns generated by that endowment to fund their charitable activities.
Because Franny's private foundation is controlled by basically one person, and it has this massive tax-exempt status where it doesn't pay normal income taxes, the federal government keeps a very, very tight leash on it. They don't trust private foundations as much as public charities.
That's very true.
And this brings us to what is arguably the most heavily tested, most critical concept in this entire section, the 5% rule.
The 5% rule is absolutely vital. Federal law mandates that a private foundation must distribute at least 5% of its non-charitable use assets annually.
Let's translate that IRS jargon. Non-charitable use assets. That basically means the investment portfolio, right?
Right.
The stocks, bonds, and cash that are just sitting in the brokerage account generating returns. Not the actual assets being used for charity, like the soup kitchen building or the medical equipment. It's just the investment pool.
Exactly. The IRS basically says, look, we gave you this massive tax exemption so you would actually do charitable work in the real world, not so you could just hoard money indefinitely in a tax-free brokerage account to inflate your own ego.
Right.
So every single year, the foundation must calculate the fair market value of that investment portfolio, and they are legally required to distribute 5% of that value to qualifying charitable causes.
So if Franny's foundation has a $100 million endowment, she must push $5 million out the door to real charities this year, period. But let's think about how this works in the real world. What if the stock market crashes? What if we hit a massive recession, the endowment portfolio is down 20%, the foundation's board of directors gets nervous, and they decide, you know what, we need to conserve cash. Let's only distribute 4% this year just to be safe. What happens?
It would be a catastrophic financial mistake.
Yeah.
The IRS penalty for failing to meet the 5% minimum distribution requirement is a 30% excise tax on the undistributed shortfall.
30%. That is not a slap on the wrist. That is deeply punitive. It is specifically designed to terrify the foundation into distributing the money. So if they fall short of their requirement by $1 million, the IRS just reaches in and takes $300,000 of it as a penalty tax.
And that's not the only tax they face. Even when they follow the rules, private foundations are still subject to an excise tax on their net investment income, which is currently sitting at 1.39%. So they aren't entirely tax-free. They pay a small toll on their investment gains.
Okay, here is a massive exam trap. We just spent all this time on the 5% rule and the 30% penalty. Are public charities like the Red Cross or a university subject to this 5% mandatory distribution rule?
No, they're not. Public charities do not have a mandatory minimum distribution rule. The 5% rule is strictly and uniquely for private foundations.
Oh, that's tricky.
It is. The exam will absolutely try to trick you by setting up a scenario where a public charity only distributed 3% of its assets and asking what the penalty is. You have to know that the rule doesn't apply to them. They have public oversight, so the IRS doesn't mandate their spending rate.
Got it. 5% rule equals private foundation only. Write it down. Now, let's talk about how the advisor actually invests this massive pile of money. Are there restrictions on what Franny can put in the endowment portfolio? Can she just YOLO the $100 million into whatever she wants?
No, definitely not. Private foundations are subject to strict rules against jeopardizing investments. They cannot make excessively risky speculative bets that threaten the foundation's ability to carry out its charitable purpose.
So taking the entire endowment and putting it into highly leveraged crypto derivatives or naked options or speculative penny stocks is off the table. If you lose the endowment on a gamble, you've jeopardized the charitable purpose, and the IRS will levy massive penalties against the foundation managers personally.
Exactly. You can't gamble with charity money.
But this raises a really, really hard practical question. Put yourself in my shoes. I'm the investment advisor for Franny's foundation. How do I invest this money? I can't be too risky because of the jeopardizing investment rule, but I also have this massive, unrelenting hurdle. I have to spit out 5% every single year in distributions, plus I have to pay that 1.39% excise tax, plus I have to combat inflation.
The tough spot.
If inflation is 3% and I have to distribute 5%, I need an 8% return just to break even. If I just invest in super safe government bonds yielding 4%, the endowment is going to slowly bleed to death. It will lose purchasing power every single year until it goes to zero. How do I solve this?
You have just perfectly described the fundamental existential challenge of endowment management. And how you solve it is governed by a very important piece of legislation that you absolutely need to recognize on the exam.
UPMFA.
UPMFA. The Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act. That is an absolute mouthful of bureaucratic jargon. What is the actual history here? Why does this act exist?
To understand UPMFA, you have to understand the crisis that charities faced in the 1970s. UPMFA applies broadly to charitable organizations holding endowments, including both private foundations and public charities. It provides the legal framework for how they must balance their competing needs.
The Balancing Act.
Right. The core challenge, as you laid out, is balancing the need to spend money today for current charitable purposes with the fiduciary obligation to preserve the purchasing power of the endowment against inflation for tomorrow. You are trying to make a pot of money last forever.
Right. And back in the day, before UPMFA, charities were legally restricted to only spending the income generated by the portfolio.
Right.
Exactly. Historically, trust law dictated that you could only spend the interest from bonds or the dividends from stocks. You were legally forbidden from touching the capital appreciation, the actual growth in the stock price.
That seems really limiting.
It was a disaster during the high inflation of the 1970s. Charities were starving. They were forced to invest heavily in high-yield bonds just to generate enough income to spend. But inflation was destroying the principal value of those bonds. They were going broke.
They were trapped. They couldn't invest in high-growth tech stocks because those stocks didn't pay dividends, and they couldn't spend the capital gains even if they did.
Precisely. So the law had to change. UPMFA revolutionized endowment management by introducing the total return approach.
Total return. What does that mean practically?
UPMFA says that an institution is no longer restricted to just spending dividends and interest. They can prudently spend from the endowment based on the total return of the portfolio, which includes both the income generated and the capital appreciation.
This is the aha moment right here. This is what liberated the nonprofit sector. If the stock market goes up 10%, but the stocks only paid a tiny 1% dividend, UPMFA says the foundation can prudently tap into that 9% capital appreciation to meet their 5% distribution requirement. They don't have to chase risky high-yield bonds anymore.
Exactly. It allows advisors to build modern, balanced portfolios. You can invest a portion of the endowment in growth equities, knowing you can legally harvest that growth to fund the charitable mission, provided your overall spending strategy is prudent, considers long-term economic conditions, and protects the purchasing power of the fund.
So on the exam, if they ask about endowment investment strategies or spending rules under UPMFA, you are aggressively looking for the phrase total return. It is the total return approach that balances current spending with preserving long-term purchasing power against inflation.
That's exactly what they're testing for.
Okay, my brain is officially full. We have covered an incredible, massive amount of ground today. We started with Paula baking bread in a sole proprietorship, watched Gary almost bankrupt them with spatulas, saw Larry hide behind an LLC, walked through the double taxation of C-Corp, navigated the strict rules of S-Corp, survived the probate trap, learned how trusts manipulate tax brackets, handled Dave's estate, and finally managed Franny's endowment under UPMFA.
It's a lot, but it all connects.
It does. Let's land this plane. We are going to do a rapid-fire rundown of the absolute most testable core takeaways from this entire deep dive. If you spaced out for a minute, lock in right now. Expert, I'm going to prompt the entity. You hit me with the golden rule. Ready?
Ready.
Sole proprietorship.
Unlimited personal liability. Zero legal separation. Pass-through taxation reported on Schedule C. Subject to self-employment tax.
General partnership versus limited partnership.
GPs have unlimited liability and manage the business. LPs have limited liability capped at their investment, but they instantly lose that protection if they step in and participate in management.
Limited liability company, the LLC.
The magic shield. Members get complete limited liability. NAD, they can actively manage the business without losing it. Pass-through taxation by default.
C corporation.
The only entity we discussed that is automatically subject to double taxation. Taxed once at the corporate level, and again when dividends are distributed to shareholders.
S corporation.
Enjoys pass-through taxation, but has strict rules. Max 100 shareholders, only U.S. citizens or resident aliens, and only one class of stock. But remember, voting versus non-voting shares are perfectly fine because the economic rights are identical.
Revocable versus irrevocable trusts.
Revocable means the grantor keeps the steering wheel, but the assets remain in their taxable estate and are exposed to creditors. Irrevocable means giving up control permanently, which removes the assets from the estate and protects them, but subjects the trust to highly compressed tax brackets.
Estates.
Fundamentally temporary accounts. The investment goal is capital preservation and liquidity, not long-term growth. Form 706 for estate taxes is due exactly 9 months after death.
Private foundation.
Governed by the 5% rule. Must distribute 5% of non-charitable use assets annually, or face a massive 30% excise tax penalty. invested using a total return approach under UPMify.
Boom. That is the cheat code right there.
It is a massive amount of information to process, I know, but understanding these fundamental structures is exactly what separates someone who just memorizes a flashcard from someone who's actually ready to sit across the desk and act as a fiduciary advisor to complex clients.
Absolutely.
And I want to leave you with a final philosophical thought to mull over as you study. We've seen how these entities start with a single human being, like Paula, trying to accomplish a simple goal. And we've watched how they morph into these massive, complex legal shields like LLCs and corporations.
Right, they just keep growing.
But eventually, they turn into irrevocable trusts and massive endowments meant to outlast us by centuries. Think about this. When you help a client set up a generational irrevocable trust, or when you manage an endowment for a private foundation, you're essentially trying to rule from the grave.
Rule from the grave.
Yeah, you're trying to predict economic conditions, stock market returns, inflation rates, and the moral needs of beneficiaries decades, maybe centuries, after you're gone. How does an advisor truly fulfill a fiduciary duty to a beneficiary who hasn't even been born yet, using a set of rules written by a grantor who is already gone?
Wow, that is heavy. Ruling from the grave. Let that bounce around in your head as you review your notes tonight. You are one step closer to crushing the Series 66. Keep grinding, keep reviewing those core concepts, and remember the why behind the rules. We'll see you on the next deep dive.